And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. We're going to have Ann Garrison a little later to talk about the Green Party because, as you know, Bernie has hit the wall, or the off-ramp. We haven't decided our metaphor. he's going to have to decide what to do. And so in the presidential elections, we often forget, other parties with ideas similar to those of Bernie Sanders, who inspired, we're going to say millions of people. And it really isn't. The Bernie story is far from over. And the Green Party, we're going to talk to Ann Garrison about Jill Stein. Jill Stein and others are sympathetic to the Sanders campaign. Their work basically complements it. And so the Bernie Sanders, as far as we know, intends to take the campaign all the way to the convention, and that is where why very powerful newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times and others are saying we'd rather he didn't do that because, of course, there is a platform issue. That is, what is that party about and what does it stand for? And the people who supported Sanders and who are his delegates, real live elected delegates, want to be there. They want to be heard. And indeed, there may actually still be an issue of who is the nominee. There's state of California has some shocking electoral issues to tell us about. There are, in my understanding, looking at the LA Times and others, it might be as many as 500,000 votes as yet uncounted in the California primary. It's something we need to know a lot about, and we're going to keep following it on the Taylor Report. And we will be talking to Ann Garrison, who lives in the Bay Area. She's been on the show previously. Everybody knows she's an authority on matters to do with Africa, and also very active in Berkeley, in San Francisco, Oakland, and that region, and is a Green Party supporter. So we'll be talking to her about what the Green Party is saying and doing at this moment. Probably 10, 15 minutes, we're going to be talking to Norman Otis Richmond, quite a well-known figure in Toronto. He is a widely respected writer, and he's self-described accurately as a bluesologist. And he, like myself and many listeners of the show, were quite interested in knowing how the final send-off, the funeral of Muhammad Ali. There's nothing that happened with Muhammad Ali that didn't have connotations, broad social connotations. So the funeral is being studied, and people are commenting on who spoke, who did not speak, and what was said and what was not said. So we'll be going over that. Of course, we're going to also review Muhammad Ali's career and look and highlight some matters that are not topically taken up. I'll just say about that, by the way, as a lead-in for Norman. I am particularly interested in the collapse of journalism around the Muhammad Ali event. We were all told when his death was announced last Friday or Thursday night that Muhammad Ali had worked out with friends and family a special funeral service and arrangement, and we saw interviews with his spokesperson, and I'm talking about mainstream reporting told us that for 9 years they had worked on this, and that Muhammad Ali had initialed and read each of the pages, and the funeral plans were at least two inches thick. And therefore, when we read or heard that there was going to be two leaders of states attending the funeral, namely the King of Jordan and the President of Turkey, were going to be in attendance at the funeral of Muhammad Ali, well, there was a ripple of interest, to say the least. And further, they were going to be speaking. We were told that the King of Jordan and the President of Turkey were going to say something. And that was the story for about a day, 2 days, maybe three. Then we were told something really interesting, that the King of Jordan and the President of Turkey would not be speaking. And then we were told they graciously accepted that. And the word in the Washington Post was they had been bumped, B-U-M-P-E-D, bumped, in favor of two other speakers, and who were at that point unnamed. So I'm ready and waiting for all my big league newspapers and CNN and others to tell me, well, what is this about? Because you have already told me that for 10 years, Muhammad Ali had planned his own funeral, and that he and that everything, and I have the New York Times headline from Saturday, or actually, no, it is it. Yes, it was on the weekend. Anyway, the New York Times headline said that it was a great event as scripted by Muhammad Ali himself. Well, did he, first of all, did he script that he wanted the President of Turkey? Did he want, and he wanted the king? If he did he come back from death and replace them? And when he did that, after having died, did he replace him with two as yet unnamed people who would be added on the day of the funeral? Well, the Times hasn't helped me out with that, nor the Washington Post, nor anybody. And if you look it up, you won't even know whether or not the King of Jordan attended. I'm going to go with a wild guess that he did not. But I'm to accept the words of a spokesperson that he graciously, that all this was done graciously. Now, what happened with the president of Turkey wasn't gracious. The president of Turkey came to the United States. He was in Louisville, and he attended the Thursday service, the Islamic service for Muhammad Ali. That was Thursday. There, he, of course, did not speak. Incidentally, he had with him the highest-ranking clergy person who he had hoped would have an opportunity to recite a prayer. That was not permitted. He did, the moment the service was over on Thursday, he then departed, and not without the kind of thing we've grown to accustom with the president of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan. This, again, remember, we're talking about a major U.S. ally, a major part of piece of NATO, and a state that is at the moment politically and morally and every other way compromised because it is pouring terrorists across its border illegally into Syria so that they can kill and maim Syrians. And this is permitted and excused and not noted by the U.S. State Department. Certainly, if you're asking about the Canadian government, relax. They're sound asleep, and they know it's not none of their business, so they don't say a word. But this is what Mr. Erdogan is doing. In the middle of this, he gets invited to come to the most famous American in the world, not George Washington, or even Bill Clinton, but Muhammad Ali, who's actually known around the world. Now he comes to Louisville, and in the funeral, after the funeral, he is exiting, and you can go on YouTube. Thank you, YouTube or internet, and you will watch his security guys get into a shoving match with the FBI, and it's the old thing. If you have two armed security groups, the first thing that's likely to happen is they'll fight each other. They're there to protect one guy, and they will kill each other. Because if you are given the job and you're elite commando, you can swim underwater for 5 minutes, all that stuff, you're ready. They put you at the door of the president. That's yours, and you're to do or die to keep that door. So the FBI guy positioned himself at the car door. So along comes the Turkish equivalent FBI, and he says, move. And the other guy says, no, I'm not moving. It wasn't my job. So then you get to watch powerful people stand around making ugly faces at each other and calling their bosses and saying, we better do something because somebody's going to get hurt. Anyway, that is the president of Turkey. Now, by the way, why isn't that called what it used to be called, the diplomatic scandal? Because this all comes under the purview of what the Secretary of State, if the Secretary of State, Mr. Kerry, you're listening, you don't know how to run anything. For sheer embarrassing incompetence, if a head of state comes, he is, whether you like it or not, or she, there are protocols, and you observe them. This is not some guy from down the street. This is not the mayor of a town in Carolina. This is the head of a government. He's a member of NATO. It's kind of important. And so the protocols are all worked out, and everything goes smooth. But this did not go smooth. Anyway, going back to Muhammad Ali, is that what he wanted? I think somebody better tell us. They said we were going to see his the two-inch book of funeral arrangements as annotated and noted and initialed by the champ himself. So I'm curious, why did he want – this will be the big question of the day. Why in the world did he want the King of Jordan? The King of Jordan isn't one of his favorite people. And why did he want the president of Turkey? Again, there are no pictures that I know of the two of them together. It's a very curious, embarrassing – but my main criticism is that we don't have any journalists who are telling us about any of this because we're all supposed to – this is Disneyland and you had a good time. This is not real live events involving heads of state – and whether or not you even have a competent State Department that can arrange to bring in high-powered visitors for an event of this magnitude. As I say, no scandal, no nothing. Everybody just looking away. But frankly, the champ was what they call a world champ. And so around the world, this is followed closely. He's the only American, most of the people in the world, care anything about. If he showed up in China, people ran to see him. If he showed up in Ghana, people ran to see him. If he showed up in Kenya. This is notorious. Wherever he went, he was loved because he was seen as the nice American. He liked to hug the leaders of foreign states, and he encouraged a thing that's an old word called peaceful coexistence. He urged states to get along and the states be mutually respectful. In this sense, he's very un-American because we now have a country that considers itself exceptional, so it can treat the president of Turkey like he's a mayor from South Carolina, and they can treat the King of Jordan like, well, we'll call you if we need you, which is pretty much seems to be how it went. Anyhow, those are all my questions. We're going to get to that a little later when we talk with Otis. I'll say on the matter of Orlando, Florida, and what happened there, this man, Omar Mateem, had an AR-15 assault rifle, and those things are man killers. That's what they're for, and it's an ugly, dangerous weapon. And it was used. This weapon was used at Sandy Hook. It was used in San Bernardino. It was used in the Aurora shooting. All these mass murders and the other places where you see these big numbers, the weapon is an AR-15 assault rifle. And the reason Americans say they can have that is the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. So, and I want to tell you something. The murderer at Sandy Hook and the murderer in Orlando are not members of well-regulated militias. So I think I put my finger on a problem. Americans are illiterate. They can't read. It says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. None of these killers with their AR-15 are members of well-regulated militias. If they were in well-regulated militias, they wouldn't be allowed to have it. When I was in the Marine Corps, we did not take our weapons home at night. You couldn't do it. That weapon had to be stored, locked, and it had to be accounted for. You didn't get to keep it. You had to be, that's being well-regulated. So this kind of madness where people are afraid to even take on the simple subject of the Second Amendment and understand it because of the political fallout from, you know, I tell you, part of it is intimidation. It's hard to argue with people who are carrying those damn things. You know, you say, well, you shouldn't have it, and you say to yourself, and I suppose he gets mad that I said that. That's where we are. We have, and incidentally, they have all these police with their tanks and their all this SWAT stuff. They didn't want to go in there. It took them 3.5 hours to get to take this guy out because, you know, when the sergeant says, okay, Frankie, get in there, Frankie says to himself, that sucker's got an AR-15. I ain't going in. I'm not. My mama didn't raise a dummy. And so people say, well, yeah, but people are being killed. Yeah. Well, see, that's the problem. Anyhow, there's a lot more to be said. I would point out an additional thing. Yes, he is from Afghanistan, his father. His father is a big Taliban supporter, has his own TV or YouTube shouting point. And and we forget who the Taliban is. I remember watching Dan Rather, CBS News, running around a hill saying, oh, the Taliban, oh, they're great guys, because they're fighting the Russians. And they were great. They were heroic. And then later they started to fight us. And I haven't heard from Dan about that, but he told us they were freedom fighters. Apparently they didn't want to be in Afghanistan. They liked to live in Florida and elsewhere. And the U.S. has romanced those guys and told us they were terrific and brilliant and that they were freedom lovers, which was a lie the first time it was ever said. This Osama bin Laden was one of these people. So the U.S. has to decide, is going to fight terrorism or not? Syria says, let's fight terrorism together. Russia says, let's fight it together. The U.S. always said, no, we don't want to be with you. Well, in other words, you want your own terrorists, and then he can have his terrorists. So let us be serious. You're not fighting terrorism. Anyway, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to speak in a few moments with Norman Otis Richmond.